Welcome to Jaded YA Reads, a YA read aloud podcast for teens, tweens, and adults brought to you by Wells Public Library. This season, we will be reading The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. Chapter 11. In 2 days' going, they rode right up the long lake and passed out into the river running. And now they could all see the lonely mountain towering grim and tall before them. The stream was strong and their going slow. At the end of the third day, some miles up the river, they drew into the left or western bank and disembarked. Here they were joined by horses with other provisions and necessaries and the ponies for their own use that had been sent to meet them. They packed what they could on the ponies, and the rest was made into a store under a tent. But none of the men of the town would stay with them, even for the night, so near the shadow of the mountain. "Not at any rate until the songs have come true," said they. It was easier to believe in the dragon and less easy to believe in Thorin in these parts. Indeed, their stores had no need of any guard, for all the land was desolate and empty. So their escort left them, making off swiftly down the river and the shortwood paths, although the night was already dawning on. They spent a cold and lonely night, and their spirits fell. The next day, they set out again. Balin and Bilbo rode behind, each leading another pony heavily laden beside him. The others were some way ahead, picking out a slow road, for there were no paths. They made northwest, slanting away from the river running, and drawing ever nearer and nearer to a great spur of the mountain that was flung out southwards toward them. It was a weary journey, and a quiet and stealthy one. There was no laughter or song or sound of harps, and the pride and hopes which had stirred in their hearts at the singing of old songs by the lake died away to a plodding gloom. They knew that they were drawing near to the end of their journey, and that it might be a very horrible end. The land about them grew bleak and barren, though once, as Thorin told them, it had been green and fair. There was little grass, and before long there was neither bush nor tree, and only broken and blackened stumps to speak of ones long vanished. They were coming to the desolation of the dragon, and they were come at the waning of the year. They reached the skirts of the mountain, all the same, without meeting any danger or any sign of the dragon, other than the wilderness he had made about his lair. The mountain lay dark and silent before them, and ever higher above them. They made their first camp on the western side of the great southern spur, which ended in a height called Ravenhill. On this, there had been an old watchpost, but they dared not climb it yet. It was too exposed. Before setting out to search the western spurs of the mountain for the hidden door, on which all their hopes rested, Thorin sent out a scouting expedition to spy out the land to the south where the front gate stood. For this purpose, he chose Balin and Fili and Kili, and with them went Bilbo. They marched under the gray and silent cliffs to the feet of Ravenhill. There the river, after winding a wide loop over the valley of Dale, turned from the mountain on its road to the lake, flowing swiftly and noisily. Its bank was bare and rocky, tall and steep above the stream, and gazing out from it over the narrow water, foaming and splashing among many boulders, they could see in the wide valley shadowed by the mountain's arms the gray ruins of ancient houses, towers, and walls. "There lies all that is left of Dale," said Balin. The mountain's side were green with woods and all the sheltered valley rich and pleasant in the days when the bells rang in that town. He looked both sad and grim as he said this. He had been one of Thorin's companions on the day the dragon came. They did not dare to follow the river much further towards the gate, but they went on beyond the end of the southern spur, until lying hidden behind a rock, they could look out and see the dark cavernous opening in a great cliff wall between the arms of the mountain. Out of it, the waters of the running river sprang, and out of it, too, there came a steam and dark smoke. Nothing moved in the waste, save the vapor and the water, and every now and again a black and ominous crow. The only sound was the sound of the stony water, and every now and again the harsh croak of a bird. Balin shuddered. "Let us return," he said. "We can do no good here, and I don't like these dark birds. They look like spies of evil." "The dragon is still alive and in the halls under the mountain, then, or I imagine so from the smoke," said the hobbit. "That does not prove it," said Balin, "although I don't doubt you were right. but he might be gone away sometime, or he might be lying out on the mountainside keeping watch. And still I expect smokes and steams would come out of the gates. All the halls within must be filled with his foul reek." With such gloomy thoughts, followed ever by croaking crows above them, they made their weary way back to camp. Only in June had they been guests in the fair house of Elrond, and though autumn was now crawling towards winter, that pleasant time now seemed years ago. They were alone in the perilous waste without hope of further help. They were at the end of their journey, but as far as ever, it seemed, from the end of their quest. None of them had much spirit left. Now, strange to say, Mr. Baggins had more than the others. He would often borrow Thorin's map and gaze at it, pondering over the runes and the message of the moon letters Elrond had read. It was he that made the dwarves begin the dangerous search on the western slopes for the secret door. They moved their camp then to a long valley, narrower than the great dale in the south, where the gates of the river stood, and walled with lower spurs of the mountain. Two of these here thrust forward west from the main mass in long steep-sided ridges that fell ever downwards towards the plain. On this western side, there were fewer signs of the dragon's moddering feet, and there were some grass for their ponies. From this western camp, shadowed all day by cliff and wall until the sun began to sink towards the forest, day by day they toiled in parties searching for paths up the mountainside. If the map was true, somewhere high above the cliff at the valley's head must stand the secret door. Day by day they came back to their camp without success. But at last, unexpectedly, they found what they were seeking. Feely and Keely and the Hobbit went back one day down the valley and scrambled among the tumbled rocks at its southern corner. About midday, creeping behind a great stone that stood alone like a pillar, Bilbo came on what looked like rough steps going upwards. Following these, excitedly, he and the dwarves found traces of a narrow track, often lost, often rediscovered, that wandered on to the top of the southern ridge and brought them at last to a still narrower ledge, which turned north across the face of the mountain. Looking down, they saw that they were at the top of the cliff at the valley's head and were gazing down onto their camp below. Silently, clinging to the rocky wall on their right, they went in single file along the ledge, till the wall opened and they turned into a little steep-walled bay, grassy-floored, still and quiet. Its entrance, which they had found, could not be seen from below because of the overhang of the cliff, nor from further off because it was so small that it looked like a dark crack and no more. It was not a cave and was open to the sky above, but at its inner end a flat wall rose up that in the lower part, close to the ground, was as smooth and upright as mason's work, but without a joint or crevice to be seen. No sign was there of post or lintel or threshold, nor any sign of bar or bolt or keyhole, yet they did not doubt that they had found the door at last. They beat on it, they thrust and pushed at it, they implored it to move, they spoke fragments of broken spells of opening, and nothing stirred. At last, tired out, they rested on the grass at its feet, and then at evening began their long climb down. There was excitement in the camp that night. In the morning, they prepared to move once more. Only Beaufort and Bomber were left behind to guard the ponies and such stores as they had brought with them from the river. The others went down the valley and up the newly found path, and so to the narrow ledge. Along this, they could carry no bundles or packs, so narrow and breathless was it, with a fall of 150 feet beside them on to sharp rocks below. But each of them took a good coil of rope wound tight about his waist, and so at last, without mishap, they reached the little grassy bay. There they made their third camp, hauling up what they needed from below with their ropes. Down the same way, they were able occasionally to lower one of the more active dwarves, such as Keely, to exchange such news as there was, or to take a share in the guard below, while Beaufort was hauled up to the higher camp. Bomber would not come up either the rope or the path. "I am too fat for such fly walks," he said. "I should turn dizzy and tread on my beard, and then you would be 13 again. And the knotted ropes are too slender for my weight." Luckily for him, that was not true, as you will see. In the meanwhile, some of them explored the ledge beyond the opening and found a path that led higher and higher up to the mountain, but they did not dare to venture very far that way, nor was there much use in it. Out up there a silence reigned, broken by no bird or sound except that of the wind and the crannies of stone. They spoke low and never called or sang, for danger brooded in every rock. The others who were busy with the secret of the door had no more success. They were too eager to trouble about the runes or the moon letters, but tried without resting to discover where exactly in the smooth face of the rock the door was hidden. They had brought picks and tools of many sorts from Lake Town, and at first they tried to use these. But when they struck the stone, the handles splintered and jarred their arms cruelly, and the steel heads broke or bent like lead. Mining work, they saw clearly, was no good against the magic that had shut this door, and they grew terrified, too, of the echoing noise. Bilbo found sitting on the doorstep lonesome and wearisome. There was not a doorstep, of course, really, but they used to call the little grassy space between the wall and the opening the doorstep in fun, remembering Bilbo's words long ago at the unexpected party in his hobbit hole, when he said they could sit on the doorstep till they thought of something. And sit and think they did, or wandered aimlessly about, and glummer they became. Their spirits had risen a little at the discovery of the path, but now they sank into their boots, and yet they would not give up and go away. The hobbit was no longer much brighter than the dwarves. He would do nothing but sit with his back to the rock face and stare away west through the openings, over the cliff, over the wide lands to the black wall of Mirkwood, and to the distances beyond, in which he sometimes thought he could catch glimpses of the misty mountains small and far. If the dwarves asked him what he was doing, he answered, "You said sitting on the doorstep and thinking would be my job, not to mention getting inside. So I am sitting and thinking. But I am afraid he is not thinking much of the job, but of what lay beyond the blue distance, the quiet western land, and the hill and his hobbit hole under it." A large gray stone lay in the center of the grass, and he stared moodily at it and watched it, the great snails. They seemed to love the little shut-in bay with its walls of cool rock, and there were many of them of huge size crawling slowly and stickily along its sides. "Tomorrow begins the last week of autumn," said Thorin one day. "And winter comes after autumn," said Beaufort. "And next year after that," said Dwalin, "and our beards will grow till they hang down the cliff of the valley before anything happens here. What is our burglar doing for us? Since he's got an invisible ring and ought to be specially excellent performer now, I'm beginning to think he might go through the front gate and spy things out a bit." Bilbo heard this. The dwarves were on the rocks just above the enclosure where he was sitting, and, "Good gracious," he thought, "so that is what they are beginning to think, is it? Is it always poor me that has to get them out of their difficulties, at least since the wizard left? Whatever am I going to do? I might have known that something dreadful would happen to me in the end. I don't think I could bear to see the unhappy Valley of Dale again, and as for that steaming gate..." That night he was very miserable and hardly slept. Next day the dwarves all went wandering off in various directions. Some were exercising the ponies down below, some were roving about the mountainside. All day Bilbo sat gloomily in the grassy bay, gazing at the stone, or out west through the narrow opening. He had a queer feeling that he was waiting for something. "Perhaps the wizard will suddenly come back today," he thought. If he lifted his head, he could see a glimpse of the distant forest. As the sun turned west, there was a gleam of yellow upon its far roof, as if the light caught the last pale leaves. Soon he saw the orange ball of the sun sinking towards the level of his eyes. He went to the opening, and there, pale and faint, was a thin new moon above the rim of earth. At that very moment, he heard a sharp crack behind him. There, on the gray stone in the grass, was an enormous thrush, nearly coal black, its pale yellow breast freckled with dark spots. Crack! It had caught a snail and was knocking it on the stone. Crack! Crack! Suddenly, Bilbo understood. Forgetting all danger, he stood on the ledge and hailed the dwarves, shouting and waving. Those that were nearest came tumbling over the rocks as fast as they could along the ledge to him, wondering what on earth was the matter. The others shouted to be hauled up the ropes, except Bomber, of course. He was asleep. "Quickly," Bilbo explained. They all fell silent, the hobbit standing by the gray stone, and the dwarves with wagging beards watching impatiently. The sun sank lower and lower, and their hopes fell. It sank into a belt of reddened cloud and disappeared. The dwarfs groaned, but still Bilbo stood almost without moving. The little moon was dipping to the horizon. Evening was coming on. Then suddenly, when their hope was the lowest, a red ray of the sun escaped like a finger through a rent in the cloud. A gleam of light came straight through the opening into the bay and fell on the smooth rock face. The old thrush, who had been watching from a high perch with beady eyes and head cocked on one side, gave a sudden trill. There was a loud crack. A flake of rock split from the wall and fell. A hole appeared suddenly, about 3 feet from the ground. Quickly, trembling lest the chance should fade, the dwarves rushed to the rock and pushed in vain. "The key! The key!" cried Bilbo. "Where is Thorin?" Thorin hurried up. "The key!" shouted Bilbo. "The key that went with the map! Try it now while there is still time!" Then Thorin stepped up and drew the key on its chain from round his neck. He put it to the hole. It fitted and turned. Snap! The gleam went out, the sun sank, and the moon was gone, and evening sprang into the sky. Now they all pushed together, and slowly a part of the rock wall gave way. Long, straight cracks appeared and widened. A door, 5 feet high and 3 broad, was outlined, and slowly, without a sound, swung inwards. It seemed as if darkness flowed out like a vapor from the hole in the mountainside. A deep darkness in which nothing could be seen lay before their eyes, a yawning mouth leading in and down. Chapter 12. For a long time, the dwarfs stood in the dark before the door and debated, until at last Thorin spoke. "Now is the time for our esteemed Mr. Baggins, who has proved himself a good companion on our long road, and a hobbit full of courage and resource far exceeding his size, and if I may say so, possessed of good luck far exceeding the usual allowance. Now is the time for him to perform the service for which he was included in our company. Now is the time for him to earn his reward." "You are familiar with Thorin's style on important occasions, and I will not give you any more of it," though he went on a good deal longer than this. It certainly was an important occasion, but Bilbo felt impatient. By now he was quite familiar with Thorin too, and he knew what he was driving at. "If you mean you think it is my job to go into the secret passage first, O Thorin, Thrain's son Oakenshield, may your beard grow ever longer," he said crossly. "Say so at once, and have done. I might refuse. I have got you out of 2 messes already, which were hardly in the original bargain, so that I am, I think, already owed some reward. But third time pays for all, as my father used to say, and somehow I don't think I shall refuse. Perhaps I have begun to trust my luck more than I used to in the old days." He meant last spring, before he left his own house, but it seemed centuries ago. "But anyway, I think I will go and have a peep at once and get it over. Now who is coming with me?" He did not expect a chorus of volunteers, so he was not disappointed. Feely and Keely looked uncomfortable and stood on one leg, but the others made no pretense of offering, except old Balin, the lookout man, who was rather fond of the hobbit. He said he would come inside at least, and perhaps a bit of the way too, ready to call for help if necessary. The most that can be said for the dwarves is this: they intended to pay Bilbo really handsomely for his services. They had brought him to do a nasty job for them, and they did not mind the poor little fellow doing it if he would, but they would all have done their best to get him out of trouble if he got into it, as they did in the case of the trolls at the beginning of their adventure, before they had any particular reason for being grateful to him. There it is. Dwarves are not heroes, but calculating folk with a great deal of the value of money. Some are tricky and treacherous and pretty bad lots. Some are not, but are decent enough people like Thorin and company, if you don't expect too much. The stars were coming out behind him in a pale sky barred with black when the hobbit crept through the enchanted door and stole into the mountain. It was far easier going than he expected. This was no goblin entrance, or rough wood elves' cave. It was a passage made by dwarves at the height of their wealth and skill, straight as a ruler, smooth-floored and smooth-sided, going with a gentle, never-varying slope direct, to some distant end in the blackness below. After a while, Balin bade Bilbo good luck and stopped where he could still see the faint outline of the door, and by a trick of the echoes of the tunnel, hear the rustle of the whispering voices of the others just outside. Then the hobbit slipped on his ring and warned by the echoes to take more than hobbit's care to make no sound, he crept noiselessly down, down, down into the dark. He was trembling with fear, but his little face was set and grim. Already he was a very different hobbit from the one that had run out without a pocket handkerchief from Bag End long ago. He had not had a pocket handkerchief for ages. He loosened his dagger in its sheath, tightened his belt, and went on. Now you are in for it at last, Bilbo Baggins, he said to himself. You went and put your foot right in it that night of the party, and now you have got to pull it out and pay for it. Dear me, what a fool I was and am, said the least tookish part of him. I have absolutely no use for dragon-guarded treasures, and the whole lot could stay here forever, if only I could wake up and find this beastly tunnel was my own front hall at home. He did not wake up, of course, but went still on and on, till all sign of the door behind had faded away. He was altogether alone. Soon, he thought, it was beginning to feel warm. Is that a kind of glow I seem to see coming right in ahead down there, he thought. It was. As he went forward, it grew and grew, till there was no doubt about it. It was a red light steadily getting redder and redder. Also, it was now undoubtedly hot in the tunnel. Wisps of vapor floated up and past him, and he began to sweat. A sound, too, began to throb in his ears, a sort of bubbling like the noise of a large pot galloping on the fire, mixing with the rumble of a gigantic tomcat purring. This grew to the unmistakable gurgling noise of some vast animal snoring in its sleep down there in the red glow in front of him. It was at this point that Bilbo stopped. Going on from there was the bravest thing he ever did. The tremendous things that happened afterwards were as nothing compared to it. He fought the real battle in the tunnel alone before he ever saw the vast danger that lay in wait. At any rate, after a short halt, go on he did. And you can picture him coming to the end of the tunnel, an opening of much the same size and shape as the door above, though it peeps the hobbit's little head. Before him lies the great bottommost cellar on Dungeon Hall of the ancient dwarves right at the mountain's root. It is almost dark so that its fastness can only be dimly guessed, but rising from the near side of the rocky floor there is a great glow, the glow of Smaug. There he lay, a vast red golden dragon fast asleep. A thrumming came from his jaws and nostrils, and wisps of smoke, but his fires were low in slumber. Beneath him, under all his limbs and his huge coiled tail, and about him on all sides stretched away across the unseen floors, lay countless piles of precious things, gold wrought and unwrought, gems and jewels, and silver red stained in the ruddy light. Smaug lay with wings folded like an immeasurable bat, turned partly on one side, so that the hobbit could see his underparts and his long pale belly crusted with gems and fragments of gold from his long lying on his costly bed. Behind him, where the walls were nearest, could dimly be seen coats of mail, helms and axes, swords and spears hanging, and there in rows stood great jars and vessels filled with a wealth that could not be guessed. To say that Bilbo's breath was taken away is no description at all. There are no words left to express his staggerment, since men changed the language that they learned of elves in the days when all the world was wonderful. Bilbo had heard tell and sing of dragon hordes before, but the splendor, the lust, the glory of such treasure had never yet come to him. His heart was filled and pierced with enchantment and with the desire of dwarves, and he gazed motionless, almost forgetting the frightful guardian, at the gold beyond price and count. He gazed for what seemed an age, before, drawn almost against his will, he stole from the shadow of the doorway, across the floor to the nearest edge of the mounds of treasure. Above him, the sleeping dragon lay, a dire menace even in his sleep. He grasped a great two-handled cup, as heavy as he could carry, and cast one fearful eye upwards. Smaug stirred a wing, opened a claw, and the rumble of his snoring changed its note. Then Bilbo fled, but the dragon did not wake, not yet, but shifted into other dreams of greed and violence, lying there in his stolen hall while the little hobbit toiled back up the long tunnel. His heart was beating, and a more fevered shaking was in his legs than when he was going down, but still he clutched the cup, and his chief thought was,
I've done it. This will show them. More like a grocer than a burglar, indeed. Now we'll hear no more of that.
Nor did he. Balin was overjoyed to see the hobbit again, and as delighted as he was surprised. He picked Bilbo up and carried him out into the open air. It was midnight and clouds had covered the stars, but Bilbo lay with his eyes shut, gasping and taking pleasure in the feel of the fresh air again, and hardly noticing the excitement of the dwarves, or how they praised him and patted him on the back and put themselves and all their families for generations to come at his service. The dwarves were still passing the cup from hand to hand and talking delightedly of the recovery of their treasure, when suddenly a vast rumbling woke in the mountain underneath, as if it was an old volcano that had made up its mind to start eruptions once again. The door behind them was pulled nearly too, and blocked from closing with a stone, but up the long tunnel came the dreadful echoes, from far down in the depths, of a bellowing and trampling that made the ground beneath them tremble. Then the dwarves forgot their joy and their confident boasts of a moment before and cowered in fright. Smaug was still to be reckoned with. It does not do to leave a live dragon out of your calculations, if you live near him. Dragons may not have a real use for all their wealth, but they know it to an ounce as a rule, especially after long possession, and Smaug was no exception. He had passed from an uneasy dream, in which a warrior, altogether insignificant in size, but provided with a bitter sword and great courage, figured most unpleasantly, to a doze, and from a doze to wide waking. There was a breath of strange air in his cave. Could there be a draught from that little hole? He had never felt quite happy about it, though it was small, and now he glared at it in suspicion and wondered why he had never blocked it up. Of late, he had half fancied he had caught the dim echoes of a knocking sound from far above that came down through it to his lair. He stirred and stretched forth his neck to sniff. Then he missed the cup. Thieves! Fire! Murder! Such a thing had not happened since he had first come to the mountain. His rage passes description. The sort of rage that is only seen when rich folk, that have more than they can enjoy, suddenly lose something that they have long had but never before used or wanted. His fire belched forth, the hall smoked, he shook the mountain roots. He thrust his head in vain at the little hole, and then coiling his length together, roaring like thunder underground, he sped from his deep lair through its great door, out into the huge passages of the mountain palace and up towards the front gate. To hunt the whole mountain till he had caught the thief, and had torn and trampled him, was his one thought. He issued from the gate, the waters rose in fierce whistling steam, and up he soared, blazing into the air, and settled on the mountain top in a spout of green and scarlet flame. The dwarves heard the awful rumor in his flight, and they crouched against the walls of the grassy terrace, cringing under boulders, hoping somehow to escape the frightful eyes of the hunting dragon. There they would have all been killed, if it had not been for Bilbo once again. "Quick, quick," he gasped, "the door, the tunnel, it's no good here." Roused by these words, they were just about to creep inside the tunnel when Biffer gave a cry. "My cousins, Bomber and Bofur, we've forgotten them. They are down in the valley." "They'll be slain, and all our ponies too, and all our stores lost," moaned the others. "We can do nothing." "Nonsense," said Thorin, recovering his dignity. "We cannot leave them. Get inside, Mr. Baggins and Balin, and you too, Feely and Keely. The dragon shan't have all of us. Now you others, where are the ropes? Be quick." Those were perhaps the worst moments they had been through yet. The horrible sounds of Smaug's anger were echoing in the stony hollows far above. At any moment he might come blazing down or fly whirling round and find them there, near the perilous cliff's edge, hauling madly up the ropes. Up came Bofur, and still all was safe. Up came Bomber, puffing and blowing while the ropes creaked, and still all was safe. Up came some tools and bundles of stores, and then danger was upon them. A whirring noise was heard. A red light touched the points of standing rocks. The dragon came. They had barely time to fly back into the tunnel, pulling and dragging in their bundles, when Smaug came hurtling from the north, licking the mountainsides with flames, beating his great wings with a noise like a roaring wind. His hot breath shriveled the grass before the door, and drove in through the crack they had left and scorched them as they lay hid. Flickering fires leaped up and black rock shadows danced. Then darkness fell as he passed again. The ponies screamed with terror,
burst their ropes and galloped wildly off. The dragon swooped and turned to pursue them, and was gone. "That'll be the end of our poor beast," said Thorin. "Nothing can escape Smaug once he sees it. Here we are, and here we shall have to stay, unless anyone fancies trampling the long open miles back to the river with Smaug on the watch." It was not a pleasant thought. They crept further down the tunnel, and there they lay and shivered, though it was warm and stuffy, until dawn came pale through the crack of the door. Every now and again through the night they could hear the roar of the flying dragon grow and then pass and fade, as he hunted round and round the mountainsides. He guessed from the ponies and from the traces of the camps he had discovered that men came up from the river and the lake and had scaled the mountainside from the valley where the ponies had been standing. But the door withstood his searching eye, and the little high-walled bay had kept out his fiercest flames. Long he had hunted in vain, till the dawn chilled his wrath, and he went back to his golden couch to sleep, and to gather new strength. He would not forget or forgive the thief, not if a thousand years turned him to smoldering stone, but he could afford to wait. Slow and silent, he crept back to his lair and half-closed his eyes. When morning came, the terror of the dwarves grew less. They realized that dangers of this kind were inevitable in dealing with such a guardian, and that it was no good giving up their quest yet, nor could they get away just now, as Thorin had pointed out. Their ponies were lost or killed, and they would have to wait some time before Smaug relaxed his watch sufficiently for them to dare the long way on foot. Luckily, they had saved enough of their stores to last them still for some time. They debated long on what was to be done, but they could think of no way of getting rid of Smaug, which had always been a weak point in their plans, as Bilbo felt inclined to point out. Then, as is the nature of folk that are thoroughly perplexed, they began to grumble at the hobbit, blaming him for what had at first so pleased them, for bringing away a cup and stirring up Smaug's wrath so soon. "What else do you suppose a burglar is to do?" asked Bilbo angrily. "I was not engaged to kill dragons. That is a warrior's work. But to steal treasure, I made the best beginning I could. Did you expect me to trot back with the whole horde of Thror on my back? If there is any grumbling to be done, I think I might have a say. You ought to have brought 500 burglars, not one. I am sure it reflects great credit on your grandfather, but you cannot pretend that you ever made the vast extent of his wealth clear to me. I should want hundreds of years to bring it up, if I was 50 times as big, and Smaug as tame as a rabbit." After that, of course, the dwarves begged his pardon. "What do you propose we do, Mr. Baggins?" asked Thorin politely. "I have no idea at the moment, if you mean about removing the treasure. That obviously depends entirely on some new turn of luck and getting rid of Smaug. Getting rid of dragons is not at all in my line, but I will do my best to think about it. Personally, I have no hopes at all, and I wish I was safe back at home." "Never mind that for the moment. What are we to do now, today?" "Well, if you really want my advice, I should say we can do nothing but stay where we are. By day we can no doubt creep out safely enough to take the air. Perhaps before long one or two could be chosen to go back to the store by the river and replenish our supplies. But in the meanwhile, everyone ought to be well inside the tunnel by night. Now I will make you an offer. I have got my ring and will creep down this very noon. Then if ever Smaug ought to be napping and see what he's up to, perhaps something will turn up. Every worm has his weak spot, as my father used to say, though I am sure it is not from personal experience." Naturally, the dwarves accepted the offer eagerly. Already they had come to respect little Bilbo. Now he had become the real leader in their adventure. He had begun to have ideas and plans of his own. When midday came, he got ready for another journey down into the mountain. He did not like it, of course, but it was not so bad now he knew, more or less, what was in front of him. Had he known more about dragons and their wily ways, he might have been more frightened and less hopeful of catching this one napping. The sun was shining when he started, but it was as dark as night in the tunnel. The light from the door, almost closed, soon faded as he went down. So silent was his going that smoke on a gentle wind could hardly have suppressed it, and he was inclined to feel a bit proud of himself as he drew near the lower door. There was only the very faintest glow to be seen. "Old Smaug is weary and asleep," he thought. "He can't see me and won't hear me. Cheer up, Bilbo." He had forgotten or had never heard about dragon's sense of smell. It was also an awkward fact that they can keep half an eye open, watching while they sleep if they are suspicious. Smaug certainly looked fast asleep, almost dead and dark, with scarcely a snore more than a whiff of unseen steam, when Bilbo peeped once more from the entrance. He was just about to step out onto the floor when he caught a sudden thin and piercing ray of red from under the drooping lid of Smaug's eye. He was only pretending to sleep. He was watching the tunnel entrance. Hurriedly, Bilbo stepped back and blessed the luck of the ring. Then Smaug spoke. "Well, thief, I smell you and I feel your air. I hear your breath. Come along, help yourself again. There is plenty to spare." But Bilbo was not quite so unlearned in dragon lore as all that, and if Smaug hoped to get him to come nearer so easily, he was disappointed. "No, thank you, O Smaug the Tremendous," he replied. "I did not come for presents. I only wished to have a look at you and see if you were truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them."
"Do you now?" said the dragon, somewhat flattered, even though he did not believe a word of it.
"Truly, songs and tales fall utterly short of the reality, O Smaug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities," replied Bilbo.
"You have nice manners for a thief and a liar," said the dragon. "You seem familiar with my name, but I don't seem to remember smelling you before. Who are you, and where do you come from, may I ask?"
"You may indeed. I come from under the hill, and under the hills and over the hills my path led, and through the air. I am he that walks unseen."
"So I can well believe," said Smaug, "but that is hardly your usual name."
"I am the clue finder, the web cutter, the stinging fly. I was chosen for the lucky number."
"Lovely titles," sneered the dragon, "but lucky numbers don't always come off. I am he that buries his friends alive and drowns them and draws them alive again from the water. I came from the end of a bag, but no bag went over me."
"These don't sound so credible," scoffed Smaug.
"I am the friend of bears and the guest of eagles. I am ringwinner and luckwearer, and I am barrel rider," went on Bilbo, beginning to be pleased with his riddling.
"That's better," said Smaug, "but don't let your imagination run away with you."
This, of course, is the way to talk to dragons, if you don't want to reveal your proper name, which is wise, and don't want to infuriate them by a flat refusal, which is also very wise. No dragon can resist the fascination of riddling talk and of wasting time trying to understand it. There was a lot here which Smaug did not understand at all, though I expect you do, since you know all about Bilbo's adventures to which he was referring. But he thought he understood enough, and he chuckled in his wicked inside. "I thought so last night," he smiled to himself. "Lake men, some nasty scheme of those miserable tub-trading lake men, or I'm a lizard. I haven't been down that way for an age or an age, but I will soon alter that."
"Very well, old Beryl Rider," he said aloud. "Maybe Beryl was your pony's name, and maybe not, though it was fat enough. You may walk unseen, but you did not walk all the way. Let me tell you, I ate 6 ponies last night, and I shall catch and eat all the others before long. In return for the excellent meal, I will give you 1 piece of advice for your good. Don't have any more to do with the dwarves than you can help."
"Dwarves," said Bilbo in pretend surprise.
"Don't talk to me," said Smaug. "I know the smell and taste of dwarf. No one better. Don't tell me that I can eat a dwarf-ridden pony and not know it. You'll come to a bad end."
"If you go with such friends, thief Barrel Rider, I don't mind if you go back and tell them so from me." But he did not tell Bilbo that there was one smell he could not make out at all, hobbit smell. It was quite outside his experience and puzzled him mightily.
"I suppose you got a fair price for that cup last night," he went on. "Come now, did you? Nothing at all. Well, that's just like them. And I suppose they are skulking outside, and your job is to do all the dangerous work and get what you can when I'm not looking, for them? And you will get a fair share? Don't you believe it. If you get off alive, you will be lucky."
Bilbo was now beginning to feel really uncomfortable. Whenever Smaug's roving eye, seeking for him in the shadows, flashed across him, he trembled, and an unaccountable desire seized hold of him to rush out and reveal himself and tell all truth to Smaug. In fact, he was in grievous danger of coming under the dragon spell. But plucking up courage, he spoke again.
"You don't know everything, old Smaug the Mighty," said he. "Not gold alone brought us hither."
"Ha ha! You admit the us, laughed Smaug. Why not just say us 14 and be done with it, Mr. Lucky Number? I am pleased to hear that you had other business in these parts beside my gold. In that case, you may, perhaps, not altogether waste your time. I don't know if it has occurred to you that, even if you could steal the gold bit by bit, a matter of 100 years or so, you could not get it very far. Not much use on the mountainside, not much use in the forest. Bless me, had you ever thought of the catch? A 14th share, I suppose, or something like it. Those were the terms, huh? But what about delivery? What about cartage? What about armed guards and tolls? And Smaug laughed aloud. He had had a wicked and wily heart, and he knew his guesses were not far out, though he suspected that the lake men were at the back of the plans, and that most of the plunder was meant to stop there in a town by the shore that in his young days had been called Escaroth. You will hardly believe it, but poor Bilbo was really very taken aback. So far, all his thoughts and energies had been concentrated on getting to the mountain and finding the entrance. He had never bothered to wonder how the treasure was to be removed, certainly never how any part of it that might fall to his share was to be brought back all the way to Bag End Underhill. Now a nasty suspicion began to grow in his mind. Had the dwarves forgotten this important point too? Or were they laughing in their sleeves at him all the time? That is the effect that dragon talk has on the inexperienced. Bilbo, of course, ought to have been on his guard, but Smaug had rather an overwhelming personality. I tell you, he said in an effort to remain loyal to his friends and to keep his end up, that gold was only an afterthought with us. We came over hill and under hill by wave and wind for revenge. Surely, old Smaug, the unassessably wealthy, you must realize that your success has made you some bitter enemies? Then Smaug really did laugh, a devastating sound which shook Bilbo to the floor, while far up in the tunnel the dwarves huddled together and imagined that the hobbit had come to a sudden and nasty end. Revenge, he snorted, and the light of his eyes lit the hall from floor to ceiling like scarlet lightning. Revenge! The king from under the mountain is dead, and where are his kin that dare seek revenge? Geryon, lord of Dale, is dead, and I have eaten his people like wolf among the sheep. And where are his son's sons that dare approach me? I kill where I wish, and none dare resist. I laid low the warriors of old, and their like is not in the world today. Then I was but young and tender. Now I am old and strong, 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 thief in the shadows, he gloated. My armor is like tenfold shields, my teeth are swords, my claws spears, and the shock of my tail a thunderbolt, my wings a hurricane, and my breath death. I have always understood, said Bilbo in a frightened squeak, that dragons were softer underneath, especially in the region of the, chest, but doubtless one so fortified has thought of that. The dragon stopped short in his boasting. Your information is antiquated, he snapped. I am armored, above and below, with iron scales and hard gems. No blade can pierce me. I might have guessed it, said Bilbo. Truly, there can be nowhere to be found the equal of Lord Smaug the Impenetrable. What magnificence to possess a waistcoat of fine diamonds! Yes, it is rare and wonderful indeed, said Smaug, absurdly pleased. He did not know that the hobbit had already caught a glimpse of his peculiar undercovering on his previous visit, and was itching for a closer view for reasons of his own. The dragon rolled over. Look, he said, what do you say to that? Dazzlingly marvelous! Perfect! Flawless! Staggering! Exclaimed Bilbo aloud, but what he thought inside was, old fool, why, there is a large patch in the hollow of his left breast, as bare as a snail out of its shell. After he had seen that Mr. Baggins' one idea was to get away. Well, I really must not detain your magnificence any longer, he said, or keep you from a much-needed rest. Ponies take some catching, I believe, after a long start. And so do burglars, he added as a parting shot, as he darted back and fled up the tunnel. It was an unfortunate remark, for the dragon spouted terrific flames after him, and fast though he sped up the slope, he had not gone nearly far enough to be comfortable before the ghastly head of Smaug was thrust against the opening behind. Luckily, the whole head and jaws could not squeeze in, but his nostrils sent forth fire and vapor to pursue him, and he was nearly overcome, and stumbled blindly on in great pain and fear. He had been feeling rather pleased with the cleverness of his conversation with Smaug,
but his mistake at the end shook him into better sense. "Never laugh at live dragons, Bilbo, you fool," he said to himself, and it became a favorite saying of his later, and passed into proverb. "You aren't nearly through this adventure yet," he added, and that was pretty true as well. The adventure was turning into evening when he came out again and stumbled and fell into a faint on the doorstep. The dwarves revived him and doctored his scorches as well as they could, but it was a long time before the hair on his back of his head and his heels grew properly again. It had all been singed and frizzled right down to the skin. In the meanwhile, his friends did their best to cheer him up, and they were eager for his story, especially wanting to know why the dragon had made such an awful noise, and how Bilbo had escaped. But the hobbit was worried and uncomfortable, and they had difficulty in getting anything out of him. On thinking things over, he was now regretting some of the things he had said to the dragon, and was not eager to repeat them. The old thrush was sitting on a rock nearby, with his head cocked on one side, listening to all that was said. It shows what an ill temper was in. He picked up a stone and threw it at the thrush, which merely fluttered aside and came back. "Drat the bird," said Bilbo crossly. "I believe he is listening, and I don't like the look of him." "Leave him alone," said Thorin. "The thrushes are good and friendly. This is a very old bird indeed, and is maybe the last left of the ancient breed that used to live about here, tamed at the hands of my father and grandfather. They were a long-lived and magical race, and this might even be one of those who were alive then, a couple of hundred of years or more ago. The men of Dale used to have the trick of understanding their language, and used them for messengers to fly to the men of the lake and elsewhere. Well, he'll have news to take to Lake Town, all right, if that is what he's after," said Bilbo, "though I don't suppose there are any people left that trouble with thrush language." "Why, what has happened?" cried the dwarves. "Do go on with your tale." So Bilbo told them all he could remember, and he confessed that he had a nasty feeling that the dragon guessed too much from his riddles and added to the camps and the ponies. "I am sure he knows we came from Lake Town and had help from there, and I have a horrible feeling that his next move may be in that direction. I wish to goodness I had never said that about Beryl Rider. It would make even a blind rabbit in these parts think of the lake men." "Well, well, it cannot be helped, and it is difficult not to slip in talking to a dragon, or so I have heard," said Balin, anxious to comfort him. "I think you did very well, if you ask me." "You found out one more very useful thing at any rate, and got home alive, and that is more than most can say who have had words with the likes of Smaug. It may be a mercy and a blessing yet to know of the bare patch in the old worm's diamond waistcoat." That turned the conversation, and they all began discussing the dragon slayings historical, dubious, and mythical, and the various sorts of stabs and jabs and undercuts, and the different arts, devices, and stratagems that which they had been accomplished. The general opinion was that catching a dragon napping was not as easy as it sounded, and the attempt to stick one or prod one asleep was more likely to end in disaster than a bold frontal attack. All the while they talked, the thrush listened, till at last when the stars began to peep forth, it silently spread its wings and flew away. And all the while they talked, and the shadows lengthened, Bilbo became more and more unhappy, and his foreboding grew. At last he interrupted them. "I am sure we are very unsafe here," he said, "and I don't see the point of sitting here. The dragon has withered all the pleasant green, and anyway, the night has come, and it is cold. But I feel it in my bones that this place will be attacked again. Smaug knows now how I came down to his hall, and you can trust him to guess where the other end of the tunnel is. He will break all this side of the mountain to bits, if necessary, to stop up our entrance, and if we are smashed with it, the better he will like it." "You are very gloomy, Mr. Baggins," said Thorin. "Why has not Smaug blocked the lower end, then, if he is so eager to keep us out?" "He is not, or we should have heard him." I don't know, because at first he wanted to try and lure me in again, I suppose, and now perhaps he is waiting till after tonight's hunt. Or perhaps he does not want to damage his bedroom if he can help it. But I wish you would not argue. Smaug will be coming out at any minute now, and our only hope is to get well in the tunnel and shut the door." He seemed so much in earnest that the dwarves at last did as he said, though they delayed shutting the door. It seemed a desperate plan, for no one knew whether or how they could get it open again from the inside, and the thought of being shut in a place, which the only way out led through the dragon's lair, was not one they liked.
Also, everything seemed quite quiet, both outside and down the tunnel. So for a longish while, they sat inside, not far down from the half-open door, and went on talking. The talk turned to the dragon's wicked words about the dwarves. Bilbo wished he had never heard them, or at least that he could feel quite certain that the dwarves were now absolutely honest when they declared that they had never thought at all about what would happen after the treasure had been won. "We knew it would be a desperate venture," said Thorin, "and we knew that still, and I still think that when we have won it, it will be time enough to think what you were to do about it. As for your share, Mr. Baggins, I assure you we are more than grateful, and you shall choose your own 14th, as soon as we have anything to divide. I am sorry if you are worried about transport, and I admit the difficulties are great. The lands have not become less wild in the passage of time, rather the reverse. But we will do whatever we can for you, and take our share of the cost when the time comes. Believe me or not, as you like." From that, the talk turned to the great hoard itself and to the things that Thorin and Balin remembered. They wondered if they were still lying there unharmed in the hall below, the spears that were made for the armies of the great King Bladorthin, long since dead. Each had a thrice-forged head, and their shafts were inlaid with cunning gold, but they were never delivered or paid for. Shields made for warriors long dead, the great golden cup of Thror, two-handed, hammered and carven with birds and flowers whose eyes and petals were of jewels. Coats of mail gilded and silvered and impenetrable, the necklace of Geryon, Lord of Dale, made of 500 emeralds green as grass, which he gave for the arming of his eldest son in a coat of dwarf-linked rings, the like of which had never been made before, for it was wrought of pure silver to the power and strength of triple steel. But fairest of all was the great white gem, which the dwarves had found beneath the roots of the mountain, the heart of the mountain, the Arkenstone of Thrain. The Arkenstone," murmured Thorin in the dark, half dreaming with his chin upon his knees. "It was like a globe with a thousand facets. It shone like silver in the firelight, like water in the sun, and snow under the stars, like rain upon the moon." But the enchanted desire of the hoard had fallen from Bilbo. All through their talk, he was only half listening to them. He sat nearest to the door with one ear cocked for any beginnings of a sound without. His other was alert for echoes beyond the murmurs of the dwarf, for any whisper of a movement from far below. Darkness grew deeper, and he grew ever more uneasy. "Shut the door," he begged them. I fear that dragon in my marrow. I like this silence far less than the uproar of last night. Shut the door before it is too late." Something in his voice gave the dwarfs an uncomfortable feeling. Slowly, Thorin shook off his dreams, and getting up, he kicked away the stone that wedged the door. Then they thrust upon it, and it closed with a snap and a clang. No trace of a keyhole was left there on the inside. They were shut in the mountain, and not a moment too soon. They had hardly gone any distance down the tunnel, when a blow smote the side of the mountain like the crash of battering rams, made of forest oaks and swung by giants. The rock boomed, the walls cracked, and stones fell from the roof on their heads. What would have happened if the door had still been open, I don't like to think. They fled further down the tunnel, glad to be still alive, while behind them outside they heard the roar and rumble of Smaug's fury. He was breaking rocks to pieces, smashing wall and cliff with the lashings of his huge tail, till their little lofty camping ground, the scorched grass, the thrush's stone, the snail-covered walls, the narrow ledge, and all disappeared in a jumble of smithereens, and an avalanche of splintered stones fell over the cliff into the valley below. Smaug had left his lair in silent stealth, quietly soared into the air, and then floated heavy and slow in the dark like a monstrous crow, down the wind towards the west of the mountain, in the hopes of catching unawares something or somebody there, and of spying the outlet to the passage which the thief had used. This was the outburst of his wrath when he could find nobody and see nothing, even where he guessed the outlet must actually be. After he had let off his rage in this way, he felt better, and he thought in his heart that he would not be troubled again from that direction. In the meanwhile, he had further vengeance to take. "Barrel rider," he snorted, "your feet came from the waterside, and up the water you came without a doubt. I don't know your smell, but if you are not one of those men of the lake, you had their help. They shall see me and remember who is the real king under the mountain." He rose in fire and went away south towards the running river.